He smiles broadly as she agrees to accompany him. It's easier than he thought to convince them that he's on their side, that he's safe, and has their best interests at heart. Perhaps he'll let this one live, he thinks, as they start the journey to what she believes is a wonderful new life. Or maybe he'll just let his darkest desires take over again. This is True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to episode 198, The Serial Crimes of Elifazi Msomi. This episode is sponsored by the brand new release movie, Not Without Hope. I've mentioned before how I really enjoy movies that are based on real life events, and this film is one of those. As true crime consumers, we're often faced with stories in which, at some point, all those involved really have left is a shred of hope. The events on which this movie is based are a perfect encapsulation of that. When four friends head out on a deep sea fishing expedition, it's meant to be a fun day out with like-minded buddies enjoying the sun, sea, and their shared love of angling. But when an unexpected storm hits, the young men's lives are quite literally turned upside down as their boat capsizes. Now, the group must fight 14-foot waves, freezing water, dehydration, and perhaps the deadliest of all, quickly fading hope that they will be rescued in time. Starring Zachary Levi, Josh Duhamel, and Jo Beth Williams, and directed by Joe Carnahan, Not Without Hope released in cinemas last week Friday, and if you haven't watched it yet, I'm not quite sure what you're waiting for. If you'd like to support the podcast and grab some True Crime South Africa branded merch, listen up. CCSA has partnered up with the SA Criminologist platform, and if you head over to their website now, you can stock up on a wide range of true crime-themed merch, including tumblers, stickers, pens, mugs, and so much more. And if you use the code TCSA at checkout, you'll get a site-wide discount of 10%. Check out the full range of true crime-themed merch at sacriminologist.co.za. And support TCSA while grabbing some truly cool goodies for you or your partner in crime. Shout out to this week's Patreon and PayPal superstars. A huge thank you goes out to Hayley Barrett, Alison Buerta, Danette Whelan, Janeka Botma, Lauren Thompson, and Helene Botma for your support on Patreon. Thank you so much, everyone. Your support really does make a huge difference. You know that occasionally I like to take a dive into some vintage true crime. The older stuff is often really interesting, and as I've said before, has this habit of showing us how much has changed and how much has stayed the same. Today's case is actually one of the most requested vintage crime cases, along with Daisy Domelka, and I think it's because this offender was firstly pretty terrifying. He was also one of our very first experiences of a serial killer, before we even had a term for it. And also because there was a bit of a paranormal link to the case, which made it the stuff of whispered ghost stories throughout history. In researching this case, I used a chapter from Dr. Mickey Pistorius's book, Strangers on the Street, some information from Dr. Gerard Labiskakhni's podcast, Profiler Africa, general information about traditional African beliefs which feature in the case from the book The Devil Made Me Do It by Nikki Falkoff, and one or two media articles published over the years. So let's get into episode 198, The Serial Crimes of Elifazi Msomi.
The following episode may contain sensitive material including descriptions of violence, sexual assault, or graphic descriptions of injuries to victims. If you feel you may be triggered by such material, please consider this before accessing our content. To access trauma counseling or services, please see the helpline information on our show notes.
Before I dive into the specifics of the case, I want to say that if you're one of those listeners who likes to Google the case while you listen, I would not recommend that until you've finished this episode. There is very little available on the internet in terms of articles or blogs related to this case that are actually accurate. The only two publicly available sources that are verifiable and accurate are by Dr. Mickey Pistorius and Dr. Gerard Labiskakhni, because they based their coverage on the actual case documents from the Investigative Psychology Unit's archives. Even the Wikipedia page on this case is based on this really weird article published in the British press at the time of the crimes, which, while probably just indicative of the time in which it was published, is inaccurate, very oddly angled, and frankly, completely racist. I found so many South African true crime cases to be incorrectly captured on Wikipedia, in fact, that I've actually started working toward becoming an official Wikipedia writer so that I can fix the stuff. That's how much it bothers me. Anyway, that's a conversation for another time. Just know that if you Google now, it's not going to be super helpful. Rather, get the facts of the case first, and then if you want to, you can do more digging when you're armed with knowledge. The setting for today's case is one in which its beauty belies the terrible things that would be done there. And I don't just mean by the serial killer. The KwaZulu-Natal Midlands are known for their green rolling hills, fertile land, and the historic sites that dot around the area, which in the 1950s was known as the last bastion of British control in South Africa. Today, the Midlands are very popular as a tourist destination, but it's also an important agricultural area. In the early 1950s, when Elifazi Msomi was in his mid-30s and taking over the family business after his father had died, the Midlands were, like the rest of South Africa, in the clutches of apartheid rule. And of course, in addition, for context, it's important for us to think about the technology and transport system side of things. The modern road systems that we know today only really started being constructed in the 1950s, and rural agricultural areas like those we're talking about today were definitely low down on the list for those until the 70s and 80s at least. In terms of technology, there were obviously no cell phones. In fact, at this time, even landlines were the purveyor of the relatively wealthy, and certainly weren't incredibly common in all homes. In terms of investigative tools and knowledge available to the police in South Africa, as I mentioned earlier, the term serial killer wasn't even really coined yet internationally. That would only become mainstream in the 1980s. As we'll discuss later, forensic psychiatry knowledge was also very rudimentary around this time, although they certainly were already starting to consider how the mind might play a role in criminality. Fingerprinting was being used in a form by this time, but there was also very limited knowledge about comparison. And sadly, internationally, there are many people who were wrongly convicted in the early days of fingerprint evidence. Ballistics had started developing and was being used in some cases. The science of forensic pathology was also still relatively rudimentary, with a huge amount of knowledge developing in this arena from the 70s onwards, along with DNA testing and a better understanding of the human anatomy. Of course, DNA wasn't used in South Africa until the 1990s, and nothing was digitized in the 50s either, mostly because there was nothing to digitize it to. So that just gives you a picture of what type of backdrop the series occurs against. And I will caution that this doesn't mean criminal investigations were poor quality. In fact, because they didn't have many of these fancy tools to rely on, investigations were often a lot more thorough. But they did rely on witness testimony and confessions a lot. Elifazi Nsomi's father practiced as an inyanga, or herbal doctor. Inyanga is an isiZulu term, but it's also used in isiXhosa. An inyanga falls under the same spectrum of traditional healing that a sangoma would, but the traditional roles for each are slightly different. Sangomas focus predominantly on spiritual healing, communicating with ancestors via trance or divination, and acting as mediums, while inyangas focus more on physical ailments and using nature as a pharmacy, often working alongside sangomas, diagnosing, then prescribing natural remedies. Elifazi had been trained as an inyanga by his father. So when the older man passed away, he took over the family practice. He managed to run the practice successfully for 7 years. But by 1952, patients began to dwindle. Many of the older, more traditional people in the area who'd been treated by his father for years were passing away, and their children, now adults, had grown up in a different, less traditional era. Colonialism had delivered Christianity far and wide, and many Zulu and Xhosa people in the area had adopted Christianity as a religion. In many ways, the traditional beliefs of their people were frowned upon by the church, and it was incredibly difficult for those growing up in traditionally African families to balance both the belief systems of a Western religion with the tenets of their own culture that they'd grown up with. Traditional healing, sangomas, and inyangas were in many ways a curiosity to Europeans, and also looked upon as incompatible with Christian beliefs. So patients were less likely to turn to traditional healers than they once had been. This is one side of it. The other side is that we know very well the traditional healing space has continued on right up until today and still forms a very important part of African tradition. So it certainly wasn't all to be blamed on that. And considering what Elifazi would go on to do, perhaps there was a more personal reason for his dwindling clientele. Either way, Elifazi would later say that he did what he thought would help, and he visited a sangoma for assistance in early 1952. He would end up visiting this individual twice, and he claimed that on the second occasion, something happened that would change the course of his life and many others. We'll get to exactly what he claimed that was a little later, but neither of his visits had any positive impact on his business, and, seemingly desperate, he left his family homestead and began to travel. We don't really know how much of Elifazi's journey after that was planned, and how much was just random and him taking the opportunities he found. But I do think his first stop, at least, was very much planned. At certain points in his journey, he would present himself as an inyanga, looking for a new place to practice out of. But often, he hid his background. At his first stop, though, in late 1952, at the home of a recently deceased man at Greenhill Farm in Richmond, he did tell the man's widow, Nomhlambi, and her brother Elijah, that he was an inyanga, seeking a new community to treat, and he asked if it would be okay if he lived on Greenhill Farm for a while. Elijah was initially hesitant, but Nomhlambi was pregnant when her husband had passed away, and as a family they were finding it difficult to get by. Elifazi promised to give them some of the proceeds he made from his work, so they agreed, and the man moved in. I just want to interject here and say that there are a lot of people, names, and places in this case. And if I include all of them, it's going to get very confusing. So I will, of course, mention the names of the key players and the victims and the most important places. But sometimes I'll just refer to peripheral players in the case as a man or a woman. Okay, back to it. Eliphazi did treat a few new patients at Greenhill Farm during his time there. But his biggest gain, if you will, is that Nomhlambi became very fond of him. She'd been helping him with his work, and they'd grown close. And soon he asked her if she would like to marry him, and they could go back to his own homestead together. Nomhlambi agreed. Eliphazi told her brother that he would come back to arrange lobola after they had settled at home, and Nomhlambi had delivered her baby. I did end up wondering at several points if Eliphazi Msomi was actually running away from something he'd done at home. Because on several occasions, he told people they were going to his home, but they never did. Instead, he'd take them somewhere else. And that is exactly what happened to Nomhlambi. The woman, relatively heavily pregnant at this point, had expected they'd arrive at Eliphazi's home quite quickly. He had, after all, travelled to her home on foot, so the journey must have been doable. But after days, then weeks, and then almost 2 full months of sleeping outdoors at night and walking during the day, Nomhlambi gave birth to her baby, with assistance only from Eliphazi. Not long after this, in July 1953, the couple and the newborn child arrived at a farm 52 kilometres as the crow flies from where they'd set out. A resident of the farm, a man called Zibbeville, lived there with his family, including his 20-year-old daughter, Olivia. Nomhlambi would later say that just before they arrived at the farm, Eliphazi told her they were going to take on a different surname, Ndlovu, while they were there, and she should just go along with it. Nomhlambi was already quickly realizing that the man she'd fallen for was not someone she really wanted to be with. But she was now relatively far from home, and she'd just given birth, so she stuck around. Upon arriving at the farm, Eliphazi told Zibbeville that his wife needed a doctor, and he asked if she could stay on their farm while he went to find one. Zibbeville agreed, and Nomhlambi and the baby stayed behind while Eliphazi left, allegedly, to find a doctor. The man would come and go for the next while, never bringing a doctor, and Zibbeville became a little annoyed. During his time there, though, Eliphazi had seemingly been grooming 20-year-old Olivia. And when he, Nomhlambi, and the baby finally left that farm, they didn't leave alone. Olivia accompanied them. It would later be revealed that Eliphazi had convinced Olivia to come with them by claiming that he was going to introduce her to Elijah, Nomhlambi's brother, as he believed they would be a good match for marriage. Olivia's curiosity had been piqued, and she'd packed her suitcase with clothes, a blanket, and, interestingly, a knife. She told her father she was going to be visiting her aunt for the night, who lived about a kilometre away. And during the night, Eliphazi collected her, and they all set off. Olivia had not told her father she was leaving, because she knew he wouldn't agree. But the young girl seemingly saw this as an opportunity to start her own life and eventually her own family. Sadly, the very opposite would be true. On the first night of their journey, the 3 adults and the baby slept out in the open, about 7 kilometres from the farm they'd just left. Nomhlambi woke in the night to Olivia screaming. The young woman told her that Eliphazi had just raped her. Nomhlambi was clearly, by this point, already terrified of the man herself, and likely thinking only of her newborn baby's safety. Eliphazi was raging and raped Olivia again. Then, while Nomhlambi watched in horror, he pulled the knife out of Olivia's suitcase and began to stab her. With a few thrusts of the blade, the young woman was soon motionless and lifeless. Nomhlambi huddled her baby against her, breastfeeding him so he didn't cry and anger Eliphazi more. She would later say that Elifazi at first tried to hide Olivia's body inside a large anthill, but when that hadn't worked, he dragged her to a cluster of bushes on a nearby hill and dumped her body there. Early the next morning, Elifazi ordered Nomhlambi up, and they began to travel again. For the next 2 weeks, the pair didn't have any contact with anyone else. Nomhlambi was in survival mode, keeping Elifazi happy and calm until she could make her move. As soon as they arrived at another farm where Elifazi decided they would stay for a bit and she felt comfortable around the residents, she told them what she had witnessed 2 weeks before. The brave young woman told the story in front of Elifazi, and the man did not deny it. The residents decided that they would take him to the local tribal chief the next day and let him arrange for the police to be summoned. Nomhlambi and her baby were given a safe place to sleep for the night, and Elifazi was housed with a group of other men who committed to keeping an eye on him. By the time the sun rose the next morning, though, Elifazi Msomi was nowhere to be found. Nomhlambi made her statement to the police and showed them where Olivia's body was. Her story could be verified because even 2 weeks later, Olivia's blood still coated the ground where she was said to have been stabbed. A few of her belongings were found at the anthill, which had clearly been disturbed when Elifazi tried to hide her body there, and drag marks from there led to the spot on the hill in the bushes where the young woman's body lay. Her father would later positively identify her, and her body was returned to the farm she'd left with such high hopes and buried there. Nomhlambi and her baby were provided with assistance to get back to her brother, and Elijah was horrified to hear what his sister had experienced. Elifazi knew very well from this point he was essentially on the run, but that didn't stop him from returning to terrorize Nomhlambi and her family on two occasions in the next few days. Eventually, the woman told him that if he didn't leave and never come back, she would call the police immediately. He did leave, and thankfully he never returned. But she did still alert the police as soon as she could get a message to them to let them know he was still in the area. The next time Elifazi Msomi appears on the confirmed timeline is in late November of 1953, when one day, quite unannounced, he arrived at the home of his aunt and uncle, Magapa and Ma Mkize Msomi. A neighbour would later say that they'd seen the couple sitting outside their home, chatting with their nephew. The man had been on his way to visit a family member of his own and waved and greeted as he went. When he returned from his visit a day later, he'd stopped at the couple's home and found Elifazi sitting inside with Magapa laying on his bed, covered with a blanket. He knew his neighbour had been unwell, so he asked Elifazi if the man was okay. He said he was, and he was just resting. Ma Mkize was nowhere to be seen. Another day passed before another concerned neighbour popped in to check on Magape's condition. They found the door closed, but not locked, so they knocked and entered. The home was empty, except for what appeared to be a sleeping Magapa on his bed, still covered with his blanket. The neighbour was concerned because the man was very still and tried to wake him. He pulled the blanket back and was horrified to discover multiple sharp force injuries all over the man's body. Magapa was dead, and he'd been so for at least a few days. Calling police in a rural area was not an easy task. The shocked residents had alerted the farm owner, who in return had alerted the staff at a nearby Roman Catholic mission, who then sent out their people to bring police back to the farm. It would later be determined that Magapa had been attacked with an axe. His wife was still nowhere to be found, and a peripheral search of the area turned up no sign of her, nor of the visitor the neighbour had seen there with what he now knew was Magapa's dead body. Another complication, of course, is that the police officer taking this call was unaware of the murder of Olivia, nor Msomi's involvement there. There was simply no quick way to pass this kind of information between districts. And although this was all happening in the same province, 50 kilometres between each scene may as well have been 1,000, without any quick way to traverse the distance or technology to quickly communicate. Several days after the discovery of Magapa Msomi's body, a vigil was arranged at the farm to commemorate the man. A farm resident was making his way to the vigil when he stumbled across the body of Magapa's wife, Mam Kize. The woman had also been hacked to death with an axe. It's actually quite uncommon for serial killers to kill members of their own family, unless that is the absolute basis of their victim selection, like a woman who marries over and over only to kill her husbands, for instance. But with a serial offender like Msomi, killing his aunt and uncle is quite a rare move. Although no one would have known that at the time, of course. We don't know if or how Msomi benefited from the murders of his aunt and uncle. It is possible there was a financial benefit to the murders, although the couple were not wealthy by any means. But these murders do mark two things in this series. A deviation from victim type, which showed that Msomi was not necessarily just a sexually motivated offender, also looking to kill his victims. And it also introduced the axe as the weapon, which is really what he would remain known for throughout history. No one else had mentioned him ever being in possession of an axe before this, so it's very likely that he'd stolen the axe from his aunt and uncle. In his first murder, Msomi had used bait to lure his victim, and this modus operandi would come up again in his crimes which now followed. Just a month after murdering his aunt and uncle, Elifazi Msomi arrived at the homestead of the Ndlovu family. The household was headed up by Banana Ndlovu and consisted of two adults, Banana's sisters, Gertrude and Lozette, and several of their children and grandchildren, ranging in age from a toddler to 20 years old. The family, like so many others in the area, lived from hand to mouth and struggled to make ends meet. So when Elifazi Msomi arrived one day in December, saying that he was working for a nearby farmer and was recruiting labourers for the coming harvest, everyone, including the children, were up for it. Msomi didn't take anyone with him that day. He said he'd come back when he was ready for them. And in a week, he did return. And 13-year-old Sisho, Hindloti, whose age was not known, Katharina, an adult, 20-year-old Dombolozi, and her infant child, Balakile, went with Msomi. About a week after he'd left with so many of Banana's family members, Msomi arrived back at the homestead with Dombolozi and her child. He told the man that the girl was experiencing headaches and couldn't work. He suggested he take 14-year-old Ntingelisi with him to work instead, and Banana agreed. A few days later, Msomi arrived back at the homestead and told Banana the children were working well and everything was going smoothly. He asked if he could sleep over that night, and Banana agreed. The next morning, though, he woke to find that Dombolozi and her baby were gone, and so was Elifazi. With almost his entire family now gone, Banana and Ndlovu began to grow uneasy. Days passed, and there was no news, and so he set off to find them. Elifazi had indicated that they were going to be working on a nearby farm, so that is where the man went. He spoke to the farmer and explained that his family members had been recruited as labourers by his foreman, and he just wanted to check on their welfare. The farmer seemed confused, called his foreman, and Banana immediately saw that this was not the man who had presented himself to him and gone off with his family members. The farmer suggested Banana wait for the workers to come back from the fields in the late afternoon, and he could see whether he spotted anyone. He did so, and as the last worker trickled in from the field, and he still didn't see a single one of his family members. A chill set over him. His next stop was Boston Police Station to report his entire family as missing. Sadly, a lot of the puzzle of the missing Ndlovu family was only put together after everything had already happened. But we now know that just a few weeks after Banana had reported his family members missing, at least two of them were actually still on the move with Elifazi Msomi. In April 1954, a man called Siboya Madladla, who was a distant family member of the Ndlovus, recognized 20-year-old Dombolozi Ndlovu walking into his homestead. She had her child with her, and they were accompanied by a man he would later come to know as Elifazi Msomi, but who, on that day, introduced himself as Dombolozi's husband. Siboya said that because he knew Dombolozi and this man was allegedly her husband, he wasn't concerned about having them stay at his homestead. They stayed for just a few days and then left. Elifazi then returned a few days later and gave Siboya a gift. It was the shirt that Dombolozi had been wearing while she was staying there. Siboya had commented that it was a lovely bright pattern, and Elifazi said the young woman had instructed him to hand it over as a thank you for his hospitality. Siboya thought it was slightly strange, but thanked him. Just as Elifazi was leaving, he turned around and asked Siboya if his teenage daughter, Dano, could accompany him to their camp. He said he'd come into a large haul of potatoes, and he wanted to share them. He'd send Dano back with the bag if she went with him. Siboya agreed, and watched as young Dano walked side by side with Elifazi into the distance. The girl did not return that afternoon with the potatoes. She didn't return the next day either, nor the next. Finally, Siboya realized something was very wrong and reported his daughter's disappearance to the police. His neighbors set out to search, and hours in, Dano's body was found. The young girl had sustained several injuries. Most appeared to have been caused by an axe. Not long after Dano's body was discovered, a police officer was called to a home where a dog had brought home a human leg. The officer followed the dog, which led him to the remains of two people, an adult female and a small child. They were soon identified as Dombolozi Ndlovu and her baby, Balekile. Dombolozi had been stripped of her shirt before being struck with an axe until she was dead. Her child had suffered the same fate. The shirt that had been gifted to Siboya had likely been taken off Dombolozi just moments before her death. Then Elifazi had used that shirt to garner favor so he could take yet another victim. A month after these discoveries, Elifazi Msomi walked into another farm. He was still calling himself Ndlovu. There he met 70-year-old Maleza Msomi, who was no relation to him. He told the man that he had a friend who was selling horses for good prices, and if he came with him, he would organize him one. The older man was struggling to get around, and a horse would be very helpful. He told his family he was going off with Elifazi to buy a horse. Maleza never returned home. In July 1954, Banana Ndlovu, having been advised of the recovery of Dombolozi and Balekile's bodies, had dwindling hope for the safe recovery of the rest of his family. And that fear was confirmed when three skulls were uncovered on the very fringes of the farm the family had lived on. The remains were identified as Hintloti, 13-year-old Sisho, and the adult family member, Katharina Ndlovu. All three had been killed with an axe. Between August and September 1954, Elifazi Msomi walked into the homestead of Zayo Ngobo. He introduced himself by a new pseudonym and had two horses with him at the time. He positioned himself as a wealthy man who lived in Richmond and wanted to marry Zayo's daughter. The man's daughter, Ntombeni, said she might be interested in being courted by the man. Elifazi said he would return with a lobola payment within a week. He did return within a week, but not with payment. Instead, her sister would later say, as Ntombeni and her sister were cutting grass in the fields, Elifazi had ridden up on the horse, lifted the young woman onto the animal's back, and left with her. For the next few weeks, Elifazi and Ntombeni travelled together. At first they were on horseback, but one night their horse ran away, and they spent the rest of their travels on foot. In September 1954, the pair arrived at the homestead of Willem Roy. There, Elifazi once again used the ruse of needing to find medical help for his wife and used a new name to introduce himself. Roy allowed Ntombeni to stay while Elifazi went off, allegedly, to find a doctor. A few days later, he returned without a doctor, and he and Ntombeni left. As had become a pattern for him, although there's no way Roy could have known this, after establishing this initial rapport, Elifazi once again returned a few days later, saying he'd come into a large haul of potatoes and he wanted to share it with Roy and his family. He asked if Roy's wife, Grace, could come with him and he'd send her back with a bag of potatoes. Roy asked where Ntombeni was. Elifazi said she was waiting back at the camp with the potatoes. Roy thought about it for a while and then said he wasn't comfortable letting Grace go with Elifazi if Ntombeni wasn't there. So he could go fetch her and then come back for Grace. Elifazi tried for a while to convince him and then left in a huff. Willem Roy would only find out much later that he'd saved his wife's life that day. On the 11th of September 1954, police were called out to the farm where Ntombeni had lived with her family before she was essentially abducted by Elifazi. There, on the very border of the land, human remains had been discovered, partially hidden in a hole in the ground. The body was identified as Ntombeni Ngobo. The girl's grieving father wondered whether Ntombeni had asked to be returned to her family, and perhaps Elifazi had pretended to agree, but then killed the girl before she could see her family again. October 1954 was a busy month for Elifazi, but it was also a month in which, although he did attempt crimes, his victims managed to escape death. This included a Sangoma and her assistant, who he lured by claiming his wife needed medical assistance, only to attack both women while they were travelling to the non-existent patient. They were able to escape and run for help, but Elifazi disappeared. Another woman was lured from her home by the man in this month too. Elifazi raped her repeatedly, and she too was able to escape. Sadly, the man's following victims would not be able to escape with their lives. And in December 1954, Elifazi was about to replicate the enormous damage he had done to the Ndlovu family with another. Near the end of the year, he arrived at the homestead of the Molo family. After a period of his usual grooming behaviour, Elifazi convinced them that he had a job opportunity for their 15-year-old son, Punu. He left with the boy and returned 3 days later, without him. He told the family Punu was working on a nearby farm and had accommodation and food supplied to him there. Next, he targeted one of the women, Makaki. She'd fallen ill while Elifazi was away, and he'd offered to take her to his friend, who was a doctor. He returned days later, saying Makaki had been kept at the doctor's home to recover and she'd be back in a week. Finally, he told another of the female family members, Man Chuchwini, that the farmer who had hired Punu would not hand over his wages to the boy and he wanted an adult family member to receive the money instead. Man Chuchwini accompanied Elifazi. Elifazi did not return to the Molo farm, and none of the three family members who had left with him did either. So the remaining family members alerted police. In January 1955, the bodies of Makaki and Manchuchwini Molo were found in the same location, not far from their home. It was likely that Elifazi had taken Manchuchwini and showed her Makaki's body before killing her there too. The following month, 15-year-old Punu's body was found in a different location. All three appeared to have been killed with an axe. As Elifazi Msomi's trail of destruction had grown, police had in the background launched a pretty enormous search for the Times. 120 police officers had been called in to hunt for the killer. While many of the murders would only be tied back to him after he was arrested, police had realized that he was connected to several of the crimes they were seeing popping up on their radar. Of course, they had no language to describe what this man was. The word serial killer had no meaning in police language at that time, and they had very little understanding of the types of motivations that would drive a predator like this. Elifazi had gotten away with so much thus far because communicating the danger lurking between people living relatively far apart was difficult. But with the danger of the man clear, police had assigned specific officers to do nothing else but travel between homesteads and farms and warn residents of the man who went by many names and had many stories to lure his victims. It is also very likely that Elifazi had come across some of the people who had been warned about him and now realized that he had to go into hiding for some time. Although he would claim another reason for the sudden stop to his series of murders, which we'll discuss later, it's clear that Elifazi had thought it best to blend in plain sight, take an ordinary job, and lay low until the investigation died down. In order to do this, he walked into another farm. But this time, he wasn't there to murder anyone, at least not that we know of. He got a job as a farm worker, which came with a room to stay. Although Elifazi would later claim he decided not to commit any more crimes after taking this job, it would actually be another crime, albeit a far more petty one, that finally got him caught. We often see prolific and dangerous serial killers getting caught for the most random of things. A traffic stop or shoplifting was something similar. And this really intricate investigation that's been going on behind the scenes actually doesn't result in the arrest. But at least the individual is put behind bars. For Elifazi Msomi, although there were 120 police officers hunting him down, it would be sweet potatoes that got him caught. One day in May 1955, the foreman of the farm he lived on noticed that there were sweet potatoes missing from that day's harvest. As it had been raining that day, there were also clear footprints in the muddy ground, which he believed to belong to the thief. So he followed them, and they led him straight to the door of Elifazi Msomi. Initially, he denied being the sweet potato thief, but the foreman was adamant, and he eventually found the stash inside his room. The police were called, and Elifazi was arrested. It would still take a few days for the police to figure out who it was that they actually had in custody. When they did, several detectives from many jurisdictions descended on the holding cells. Shortly after Elifazi was arrested, the skull of another of his victims, 14-year-old Ntengelisi Ndlovu, was found. Finally, Banana and Lovu had all of his family members returned to him, although certainly not in the way he would have preferred. Elifazi Msomi was 45 years old in 1955 when his trial began. His series of murders had held the Midlands in a grip of fear, and the horror was felt across the country and even the world, at first because of the idea of an axe murderer roaming around killing indiscriminately. But things became even more salacious once Elifazi began to make claims about exactly why he'd committed the murders. Remember way back in the beginning when I told you about how Elifazi had gone to see a Sangoma for help with getting his Inyanga business to be more prosperous, and how he claimed that the Sangoma had done something, but it hadn't been helpful? Well, when Elifazi eventually admitted having knowledge of the murders and rapes, he added that he only knew because he'd been there, and he'd lured the victims, but it wasn't him that had actually done the deeds. It was a Tokolosh. According to Elifazi, when he'd visited the Sangoma, he'd been cursed with a Tokolosh, which the Sangoma had said would only leave him when he collected the blood of 16 people. So Elifazi claimed he'd therefore had no choice but to assist the Tokolosh by luring the victims. But he insisted, did not actually kill or rape anyone. It was all the Tokolosh. So what is a Tokolosh exactly? If you're South African, you've likely heard various references to what this is throughout your life. Some of it may be accurate, and some of it may be skewed from the original stories. To get as close to the original roots of the Tokolosh as I could, I went to a recent book written by Nikki Falkoff. Nikki is a professor of media studies at Wits University. She has a PhD in interdisciplinary humanities and cultural studies from the London Consortium at the University of London. Much of Nikki's work over the years has focused on occult or occult-based beliefs and how they interact in society in South Africa, and especially how those beliefs are interpreted and absorbed by the different races that make up our country. Her work is fascinating, important, and always from multiple viewpoints. Her most recent book is called The Devil Made Me Do It. Spoiler alert, the devil did not make them do it. And I'm hoping to interview Nikki on the podcast next year. But for now, I used her book to provide an academic view on the roots of the Tokolosh concept. The Tokolosh is a concept that exists in the mythologies of many of South Africa's tribal groupings. While the actual story around the Tokolosh often varies between tribal cultures, in general, most agree that the Tokolosh is a small and vicious creature. In some tellings, they appear as almost human, although very small and malformed, and in others, they're more primate-like, although not even properly formed for that species. Some forms of the Tokolosh are focused on their propensity to commit sexual assaults, with the mythology stating that the creature has an enormous penis for their body size and will rape people in their sleep. Other forms of the Tokolosh are more trickster in nature, or more focused on killing babies or chewing off people's fingers. Tokolosh are often believed to do the bidding of witches. In many ways, the Tokolosh has become a way for parents to scare their children into navigating the world carefully, while in some instances, it helps to present a reason for things that seem unfathomable, like the death of a child. For those who have not grown up in an African culture, believing in the existence of a tiny evil creature is often something to be scoffed at. For many at the time of Nsomi's crimes, which was especially apparent in the international coverage, which heavily focused on this element of the crime, it brought forward a way for them to show the so-called uncivilized nature of the African continent. It's often difficult to understand how people can believe things if you haven't grown up being taught them. I can only imagine that the very first tribes of people in Africa and South America, for instance, upon first being approached by missionaries hoping to convert them to Christianity, would also have thought the tale they were telling was strange. But the missionaries had grown up being told the story of the tenets of Christianity, and to them, it was just their reality and their chosen belief system. So hopefully that example can help you to understand how deeply the tales we are told from birth and which are reinforced by those around us can become just a normal part of day-to-day life quite easily, while simultaneously being very odd to those who haven't had that lived experience. There's actually a very important legal case in South African history that involves the Tokoloshe, which Nikki Falkhoff discusses in her book and brings to the fore this idea of each of our realities being patently different. The case involves the 1933 death of a 9-year-old child in the Eastern Cape. The man on trial, Dumi Mbombela, had accidentally killed his 9-year-old nephew after being informed by some of the other children that they had seen a tokoloshe in one of the huts. Mbombela had grown up in a rural and very traditional isiXhosa community, in which mythologies like the tokoloshe were part of daily life. It was a very real fear for him and his people. So when the children were absolutely convinced that they had seen a tokoloshe in the hut, Mbombela had armed himself with an axe and gone in, determined to kill the creature and ensure that his family was protected from its evil. Part of the isiXhosa interpretation of the tokoloshe is that you must never make eye contact with the creature, or it will attach itself to you. Mbombela had pushed open the hut door, and in the darkness, seen just the shadow and shape of a skinny, short creature, and swung out at it with the axe in fear. Mbombela was devastated when he realized that it had actually been his nephew behind the door. Initially, when brought to trial, Mbombela was found guilty of murder and sentenced to death, because based on the idea of the reasonable man, the judge found that the reasonable man would not have believed in the tokoloshe, and therefore neither should Mbombela be able to use that as a defense. This determination was appealed against, though. And in that appeal, the court determined that one could not take the concept of a reasonable man that had been created by a predominantly European set of laws at the time and apply them to a country and a person who had completely different lived experiences. Eventually, it was determined that for the background that Mbombela came from, his actions were of the reasonable man in that community. It just didn't necessarily match what the reasonable man persona might look like in Europe, for instance. Now, this only really worked specifically in this case, because there was absolutely no proof that Mbombela had intentionally killed the child. With or without the tokoloshe element, it was clear that the man had simply made a terrible mistake, for which he was deeply remorseful. But in this case, the court had to decide whether it was fair to say that the fear of the tokoloshe could reasonably result in the actions he took, and the appeal court found that it could, and he was set free. Now, 22 years later, another tokoloshe-related case was being heard, and many wondered how much Msomi's claims would be taken into account. Of course, the circumstances of the case were incredibly different. Mbombela had never claimed he didn't kill his nephew. He never tried to lay the blame at the tokoloshe's door, so to speak. Instead, his defense was that the belief system he'd grown up with had instilled in him such a deep fear of the consequences of having a tokoloshe on his homestead that fear could have driven him to react in a way some others might not. Msomi, on the other hand, was claiming complete innocence in the rapes and murders. He said all he did was continue to lure victims for the tokoloshe, and he had stopped when 16 lives had been taken because he knew he'd broken the curse. already at this point in history, of course, those in the judicial system were aware that mental health concerns could contribute to committing crimes, and it was important to ascertain whether a person could actually be held responsible for the crime. Interestingly, though, in 1955, the assessment of this was not done before the trial started. Instead, the experts would sit in throughout the trial and assess all the evidence to make a determination. Now, this is perhaps not the worst idea, to be honest, because often the veracity of mental health claims can either be borne out or refuted by the evidence. An episode of psychosis, for instance, can be refuted by issues like a long period of time around the crime or very specific planning or cover-up. On the downside, if the person is found to be not criminally responsible, you've just put everyone through the time, expense, and trauma of a trial. We definitely could not do this today, because we just have far too many cases on the go at once. I think we're also much better at identifying actual mental health conditions that would contribute to a crime today than we were in the 1950s. This is also shown by the fact that Elifazi's trial started less than 2 months after he was arrested. The two people sitting in on the trial to determine Elifazi's mental competence was a GP who had 10 years' experience in treating people with mental health conditions and a psychiatrist with 30 years' experience. Sokolosh claims aside, this was a very complicated case for the times. This was long before our big spike of serial killers in the 90s, and most courts and police officers were not used to dealing with so many victims in so many places at different times, killed by the same person. The prosecution actually did an excellent job of handling the evidence, though, and although there was no access to some of the physical evidence tools we have today, they did rack up a wealth of evidence against Mzomi. He was identified in lineups by multiple people, and witness testimony placed him in all the locations where the victims were found. The forensic pathologist who'd looked at the victims' bodies explained the similarities in injuries and how they all matched up with an axe, except for Olivia, of course, the first victim who was killed with her own knife. The mental health specialists would eventually find that Elifazi could be held criminally responsible for his actions. They found that he did have syphilis, but this had not affected his mental capacity. They also said that he had above-average intelligence, and he was an excellent storyteller. They also used a term in their analysis, which you heard a lot around murders at this time, and that is the term sadist. Now, generally that term describes a person who derives pleasure, especially sexual gratification, from inflicting pain or humiliation on others. And in this time where there wasn't really a deep understanding of the criminal mind, it seems as though many automatically believed that anyone who killed without a definable motive, like financial or revenge, must, by default, simply get pleasure from killing, and therefore be a sadist. I almost feel as though this word was used in such a way at that time that it lost its true meaning. A bit like the way we use the term narcissist now, or how the word psycho has been used for quite some time as a catch-all phrase when someone acts in a way we can't understand. For me, it's difficult to say that someone like Elifazi Mzomi is a sadist in the true definition of the word. He killed truly indiscriminately. He showed no mercy, even for children. And his crimes often involved a sexual element. And I suspect if he were put through a mental health assessment today, there would be a good number of flags on an antisocial personality diagnosis. While some of his crimes seem to have no motive, the vast majority seem to have a sexual motive. And we know that sex crimes are not about pleasure, but about control and power. As Dr. Labuschagne pointed out in his analysis of this case, his crimes were very often quick and brutal. So there's no evidence that he drew out the pain his victims experienced because he was deriving pleasure from that. He did, however, often spend a lot of time with his female victims. And maybe he did enjoy that element of knowing what he was going to do and them having no idea. Elifazi's defense attempted to use this classification as a sadist to their advantage, though, claiming that it was a mental health defect, which meant he was not in control of his actions. This was, of course, not true in any way. Sadism is an element of what we might today call a personality disorder, or, if sexual in nature, a paraphilia, neither of which are considered a mental health defense in a legal sense. This claim was also in complete conflict with what Elifazi himself was saying, which was that he actually didn't do anything himself, sadist or not. It was the tokolosh. His defense lawyer explained, though, that this very contradiction was proof of Elifazi's ill mental health, because he was attributing his sadism to an external entity that didn't exist, i.e. a tokolosh. It was an interesting argument, to be sure, and it's actually something we see in a lot of killers, serial or not, who attempt to include an occult influence in their crimes. At some point in their journey to full disclosure, it's easier to convince themselves that their offending was caused by an external force that no one else understood. In his judgment, though, the judge said that Elifazi had only started offending 8 months after he claims he was cursed with the tokolosh. And surely, if this had truly been his predicament, he would have started to appease the entity as quickly as possible. The judge also pointed out how much planning, manipulation, deception, and cover-up was involved in the crime. Elements that he said could not be attributed to a being that was essentially set out only on destruction and bloodshed and had no need to cover up its crimes. He said it was clear that Elifazi did not stop killing just because he had reached the 16 victim count. Instead, his lying low had happened exactly when the police began to go from home to home in the area, warning residents about him. Elifazi Msomi was found guilty of 15 counts of murder in September 1955 and sentenced to death by hanging. Now you, like me, may have noticed the discrepancy here. Msomi is talking about 16 victims, and I have only listed 15 victims, and he was found guilty of 15 murders. So, was he saying that there was a 16th victim we don't know about? Or did police just not include a victim in the trial record because they could not absolutely prove he committed the crime? The answer, I have no idea. I found no explanation for this discrepancy anywhere. After his sentencing, Elifazi complained that he should have been given the opportunity to be heard in front of a council of those who were closer to him in culture and would understand the situation he'd been in. And honestly, that's not entirely unfair. But as was proven in Rex versus Mbombela, while the reasonable man assertion must be fairly applied, there is also a point at which this assertion ends. And that point is the purposeful and brutal slaying of 15 people over a long period of time with plenty of opportunity to seek other options to solve the problem. And the other side of this is that there were plenty of people who were raised in exactly the same cultural norms as Elifazi Msomi, the victims' families. And not a single one of them thought of him as anything other than a cold-blooded murderer. None of those grieving loved ones, despite also having grown up with tales of and fear around the tokolosh, could ever fathom ending the lives of 15 people, including small children, just to rid yourself of a curse, without ever trying any other way to resolve the issue. The families of these victims knew very well that Elifazi Msomi was not acting under coercion of any supernatural force, because they too had been victims of his very skilled deception and manipulation. They had witnessed his meticulous planning, and they had to live with the unassigned guilt of having fallen for his grooming. So in a way, if Eliphazium Sormi had wanted to be judged by a jury of his peers, he already had been. He'd been assessed by those who had a front row seat to his horror show, and not a single one of them believed he had committed those crimes for any other reason than because he wanted to, and he could. On the 10th of February 1956, Eliphazium Sormi was executed. The memory of his heinous crimes, though, did not die with him. In fact, they morphed. And of course, much of the focus remained on the Tokolosh element, but for the most part, in whispered tales passed down between families and generations, Eliphazium Sormi became a warning and a symbol of what absolute cold-bloodedness looked like. In 2018, 62 years after Msomi was executed, a journalist called Sithembiso Msomi wrote an article. And no, he's not related to that Msomi. But, as he says, he does get asked that question all the time. And if people don't ask, their face does this weird little thing when they hear his surname. That really says it all anyway. The basis of the article Sithembiso wrote was not to bemoan this unfortunate coincidence, though. It was to illustrate how the name of this serial killer has moved down throughout history. The first time it popped up again was not long after Msomi was executed, when a gang operating in Alexandria in Johannesburg started calling themselves the Msomi Gang. Only, as Sithembiso explains, there was no one called Msomi among them. Rather, the name was used to instill fear in their victims and their rival gangs. Sithembiso says when he's not being mistaken for a serial killer relative, he is being wrongly linked to this gang. Neither of which are true, by the way. Others have used Msomi's name to instill fear into their rivals throughout history, even in sport. An Orlando Pirates soccer player who was known for his hard tackles nicknamed himself Msomi. Boxing champ Joan Keady nicknamed himself the Axe Killer. I really feel for Sithembiso, to be honest. It got so bad that some poorly researched blog even lifted his photograph from a newspaper and attached it to an article they wrote about Eliphazi. I'm not sure how they didn't look at the quality of that photo and realize it could not have been taken in the 1950s. But anyway. I've also seen other sources on the internet with what they claim are pictures of Msomi, but that don't look right to me. And after reading this article, I realized there are actually photos of Sithembiso. And this is why I said in the beginning of this episode, Googlers beware. There is one picture that floats around. It seems to be accurate, but I can't verify that for sure. So I won't be sharing it and adding to the possible online chaos. It's not completely out of the bounds of believability that Eliphazium Sormi's name was the one that continued throughout history, used to strike fear into the hearts of victims and rivals alike. A thing which has become a moment of shame for a man who has absolutely no link to the original name carrier, besides having the same surname. That's kind of what this podcast is built on, right? The idea that we always remember the offender's name and hardly ever the victim's. Well, the next few seconds might not be able to rewrite the history of this case, nor all the damage that was done to the generations of multiple families through the horrific losses they suffered because of this man. But at least, for today, we can say their names instead of his. Olivia Kambula, Magapa and Ma Mkisa Msomi, Tisho Ndlovu, Dombolozi Ndlovu, Balikile Ndlovu, Tindloti Ndlovu, Ntinglisi Ndlovu, Katharina Ndlovu, Dano Madlala, Maleza Msomi, Ntombeni Ngobo, Manchuchwini Molo, Punu Molo, and Magaki Molo. Rest gently. If you'd like to hear more victim-focused true crime content, please subscribe to True Crime South Africa on Spotify or the platform you're using to listen right now. If you're looking for something still related to real-life stories, but often with a more positive slant, you can check out my new podcast series, I Live Through This. You can follow both podcasts on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'll be back next week with another episode. Until then, thank you for your support, and I'll chat to you soon.